Welcome to the End of Agriculture. I'm Sarah Mock.
And I'm Connie Bowen. And we're discussing the how, might, and the what if behind the end of foundational elements of agri-food systems.
All right, everybody. Today we're going to discuss the end of everyone's favorite ag chemical, glyphosate. A few notes before we jump in. One, glyphosate is the active substance in Roundup. So as part of that, despite the fact that our primary focus today will be the chemical glyphosate, we are going to have to touch on Roundup Ready crops, which are, of course, a GM, which opens up a whole kind of other related field of issues. But we're going to try and touch on them just very briefly. And then we also may have to touch on a few other major popular ag chemicals. But in general, our focus will be laser on glyphosate. So just in case anyone is new to the conversation, the end of ag conversation, we also just want to let you know that how this podcast works is we're going to first talk about how we got to where we are now with glyphosate, then we're going to talk about how it might end, what that end would look like, and then right before we sign off, we're going to talk a little bit about the reality check, which is what is most likely to happen next. So Connie, I'm going to push it over to you. Give us a little insight on how we got where we are right now with glyphosate.
Absolutely. So quick history on glyphosate. It was first synthesized in 1950, which is an awful, 70 years ago, by a Swiss company, and it was actually not published when it was first synthesized.
And it was actually first patented as a chemical chelator in 1964.
Because it binds minerals like calcium and magnesium and manganese and copper and stuff. But it actually wasn't registered as a herbicide until Monsanto registered in 1971. And that's when kind of Roundup as we know it became a thing. It was brought to market by Monsanto as Roundup in 1974. And actually, all of Monsanto's, today when we talk about glyphosate, we usually play the blame game at Monsanto, point fingers at Monsanto. But all their U.S. patent claims expired in 2000. So everyone has glyphosate blend products. And there are all sorts of, there's generic glyphosate products too.
I'll chime in here just to say, I think, in the Monsanto blame game, which is now Bayer Monsanto, when we talk about all of those companies, Monsanto, Bayer, BASF, Dow, DuPont, an interesting point of history in my mind is that all of those were chemical companies that rose to prominence during the world wars. And they basically came back from making chemicals, wartime chemicals, and needed to rebrand to maintain relevance in a peacetime world. And so a lot of them at least had part of their business go into making agricultural chemicals. So it's an interesting, there's an interesting tie between that military industrial complex and the modern conventional, high technology agriculture.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And I mean, when you look at like some of the earlier herbicide chemicals, like 2,4-D, which is still like the most, it's more widely used actually than glyphosate today. Like that one was actually it was a part of essentially good old fashioned warfare, starve them out, kind of like that was the goal, was how can we spray a chemical on our enemy's crops and force them to surrender that way. That is definitely the origin story of some of these broadleaf herbicides. And it was actually, they weren't really very effective on certain crops. And that's how, you got to the point of, if we can selectively kill only certain types of crops, that could actually be really useful in a farming setting. But actually glyphosate, at least to the best of my knowledge, was not one of those exactly. But yeah, they're all chemical companies and they did some, not so cool stuff with some of those chemicals, arguably still. And then I just wanted to talk a little bit about mode of action too on glyphosate, without getting too chem nerdy. It's a phosphonate that inhibits a key plant enzyme. I don't remember what it's called, but it's a long organic chemistry word, but essentially glyphosate leads to desiccation and that leads to plant death. And it's particularly effective on broadleaf plants. So it's not so effective on things like grasses. It's registered by the EPA in 1971. A quick note, like Sarah mentioned before, you can't talk about glyphosate and Roundup without talking about Roundup Ready crops. We're going to try pretty hard to here, but you know, Monsanto did come up with Roundup Ready crops that we're still using everywhere, actually. And that has played a significant role in shaping the way that really global agriculture functions today. Worth noting.
Yeah, I think we can take like a little pause here to do a little bit of, me and Connie have some very different thoughts and feelings on this topic, I think. And yeah, I mean, to your point, Connie, about these chemical companies literally were, they invented a plant poison. That's what these chemicals were originally used for, or many of these chemicals were originally used for, even if not glyphosate, which we do want to focus on glyphosate. And I'm going to try and do that here. But yeah, it's hard as a tech person and someone who's excited about science and who understands that the world is chemicals and we're all chemicals, to look at these chemicals and not feel and not seem, you know, that we waded into using them really aggressively long before we had a good grasp of what their effects were. And all the evidence that we had about their effects, quite to the contrary, were that they were incredibly devastating and really dangerous to have in a lot of settings. So I, in my, like a lot of that kind of history percolates up, if that's the right kind of turn of phrase, into my thinking and feeling about ag chemicals and our use of ag chemicals today, because like, you know, they had that, like, that's their origin story, and their origin story, it's really hard to escape an origin story.
Fair. That is true. I'm super excited to continue to wade into this episode. This is a great issue because Sarah and I like don't agree fundamentally on a lot of issues here. I'm kind of pro chem, Sarah a little bit less, so I think it's fair to say here. This is a fun thing for us to discuss. But in that vein, there have been positive and negative effects of the use of glyphosate, and this is part of why it's really important. We're trying to hone in on glyphosate because not all chemicals are created equal, and there are typically consequences, negative consequences, and benefits. And I think an argument could be made that the benefits of glyphosate in many instances and use applications outweigh the negative impacts. Obviously Sarah can make a case against that. We're not going to get too deeply into it, but we'll get a little bit into it, I suppose. Glyphosate absolutely has transformed the way that agriculture functions. That's definitely true.
Yes, and I think that is an important place to, an important point to tie into this conversation of where are we right now, which is that basically glyphosate enabled, was a facilitating technology and enabling an incredible amount of consolidation in agriculture. Like, it would not be possible to farm 2,000 acres of corn and soybeans if you had to manage weeds by hand, or like with a sprayer that you like hold in your hand, or, you know, without being able to broad apply like this kind of herbicide that was essentially universally useful against like almost all weeds that you would see in a field, it would be impossible to farm the way that we farm now. And yeah, I mean, I have lots of feelings about the way we farm now, but I'll go ahead and let Connie make some comments about that.
Yeah, that's totally true. It's absolutely true. I mean, the flip side of the benefit of that, though, I don't know for anyone who has spent a lot of time weeding, even like, you know, and I'm not talking about weeding your garden, but I'm talking about actually, weeding many acres of organic production, which I've done. That sucks. And I'm lucky enough to be able to do it in a way that I don't need that income, and I'm not in a vulnerable position, you know, getting into labor ethics, which I know is one of our mutually favorite topics. I would rather have some negative environmental consequences. And I say that as someone who doesn't want to have negative environmental consequences, but I would rather have some negative environmental consequences in order to ensure that people aren't doing horribly difficult manual work. And I think that we have absolutely been able to expand the scale of agriculture agricultural output in large part because of spray application of pesticides, especially glyphosate, but not exclusively glyphosate. And I'll say too, so now, you know, again, where are we today? We're at a point where we've got a serious resistance problem that we're now going backwards in kind of our chemical arsenal and pulling things like dicamba, which, again, not going to talk too much about it, but, you know, it's older than, it was pre-glyphosate. We know it's a risk, high, it's a higher risk profile for a number of different reasons than does glyphosate. Yet because of excess use of glyphosate, yeah, I think that's pretty much the direct causer. Because of that, we've had to pull, or maybe we didn't have to, but the reaction has been to say, all right, we're going to throw the whole kitchen sink at this problem. But are we, in doing so, it would seem that we might be making the problem worse.
And yes, to the labor issues that you snuck in at the beginning, we need to talk about that so much more. And I'm going to leave it there until a little bit later in the podcast. But to the point about, because resistance is a real problem today, a really significant problem with both resistant weeds. And we actually have some, again, not something we'll talk about, resistant insects with other chemicals and other technologies. But the problems with resistance are directly related to misuse. And so I think that'd be great. I have lots of thoughts and feelings about that. I want to push it back to you though, and get us started on how this might end and what that would look like. And I'll plug back into my thoughts as we get a little further on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah. And in a way, misuse is what's leading to, you know, you can't have too much of a good, you have a good thing and you abuse it and then it gets taken away from you because you've done, you know, drinking too much can be a problem. Eating too much ice cream, it's a problem. It's good when you have just a little bit. It's not good when you just are reckless. And so, where we're at now, legislation is starting to become a factor. There's been a ton of, now, less effective. There's been Roundup lawsuits that have been won. So there's lawsuits in the US, but I think more notably, there's been legislation in the EU, and even recently they've released their kind of farm to fork strategy that definitely pushes them further away from chemical agriculture pretty broadly, actually. And this is where, again, I want to talk about glyphosate. Unfortunately, at least in my mind, it is unfortunate that often all chemical agriculture gets lumped together because, like I kind of got to before, dicamba, glyphosate, very different risk profiles. And so when we talk about, you know, the kind of tools in the farmer toolbox to deal with all sorts of variables that are real and real challenges that you have to do something about, it feels like in some places we're getting into a space where legislation and you know, political will pushes us towards pure elimination of chemical agriculture as opposed, and glyphosate is a weird one because it's been so branded that it gets more demonized, I guess. So I don't know. That's an interest. The legislation thing, will anything happen in the U.S.? I don't think so, but maybe. Like, it's not impossible.
Yeah, I think for glyphosate, it's much more likely to get for the use to go down significantly due to just increased demand for organics, which like isn't good, right? We know that like organic chemicals are worse in a lot of cases than you know, conventional chemicals. We know that organic is not using chemicals. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'm just like a USDA pessimist, but I just don't know that we have any kind of desire on the regulatory side to do anything. I think it's much more likely to be a market based.
No, I think you're right. But the two things regulatorily, that's not a word, but along this vein that could like, I don't know that they will, but that I think would be effective levers are, one, I think that taxing ag chemicals would be really, really, really interesting. I never hear people talk about it. I'd love to hear people talk about it. I also think, and this kind of goes into the next one, which is consumer demand, and that's kind of what you're alluding to, Sarah, but like, I think that when you think about exports, that's where, and that's why it matters what happens in other countries in a global economy, because, you know, I'm working on a project on sustainable soy exports from the US to the EU. And if the EU sets certain rules, then the growers are going to need them, because maybe they can get a premium, but eventually they can only sell to that market because they meet those requirements, and maybe those requirements are glyphosate free.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it goes to other conversations we've had about commodities, end of commodities. We're like, yeah, when the commodity regulation stipulation is just that it's organic. Yeah, it's the same thing. Like when generic corn, global commodity corn, recognized commodity corn has to be grown without glyphosate, like then we'll cut back on our use of glyphosate probably. But I mean, this also gets to a whole nother question, which is just like, also farmers lie. They like use chemicals off label. They violate, you know, they use things like they're not supposed to. They spray after the time, you know, outside of the windows that they're supposed to. And then they just like say they don't.
Yeah, no, that's totally true. I know, it's mind-blowing that, like, I don't think enough people realize kind of the mentality around dishonesty, right? Like, I'm, like, a stupid, honest person. I literally can't even play the card game BS. So, like, this was something that was, like, so eye-opening for me. I also consider, it's funny because we have this perception of like farmers as being very honest people. And actually there's just some Farm Bureau report that I was reading, I think 2 days ago, that like 74 or 82, I don't remember exact percentage, but some majority of the American population trusts farms, just inherently trust farmers. And that's, you know, I also trust farmers about a lot of things, but there's this kind of sense of I know better than you know because I'm the manager managing the land. And I actually do believe that to be true, but I believe that that can be true. But let me clarify. I believe that that can be true. It isn't always true. There are good farmers and there are bad farmers, as is true of all operators of anything.
Yes.
And I think, Sarah, probably you're going to want to get down to the point of how glyphosate can make you maybe allow less good farmers to function.
Yes, absolutely. Like, I think that is the fundamental, like, kind of bad economic outcome of glyphosate. It's, right, it's stupid proofs agriculture. Like, I want, it sounds weird and counterproductive maybe, and I understand that, but I want farming to be a bit harder. I want you to have to be good at it. I don't want you to be able to do it like without actually having like skill to do it successfully. And glyphosate makes it easier to do it on nights and weekends and poorly and without the skill and without the like focus. And I don't like that.
Okay, wait, I want to jump in and I think that I'm going to clarify. And I think that what I'm going to say, you agree with, but tell me if not, I'm sure you will. what you don't mean that you want the business of farming to be more challenging and competitive, right? You don't, like, farming's about to get harder because of climate change, period, for sure, definitely. And yeah, increased weather volatility. I don't think that we necessarily want, you know, I struggle. Like, you want farming to be harder and you want farming to be more competitive.
Yes, that is true. Good clarification. I do want farming to be more competitive and I want it to demand more management skill and like more, basically I want farming to be about brain power, not about muscle power or technology power, because basically like brain power is better at doing things well, like better at all the, like in my mind, there's three outcomes that we care about in farming. Good food, like healthy, affordable food, good jobs, and good environmental outcomes. And brains are better at optimizing for any of those three and all three of them at once than like technology or labor. Yeah, like muscle power.
Yeah. Right. Use a lever, don't use a short wrench.
Yeah. And so it's, for me, it's like I want, right? The reason why, one of the reasons why we like giant farm equipment and we like ag chemicals and we like traits that allow you to grow like, you know, infinite rows of corn to the horizon is because it lets one guy do that all by himself. There's no other industry where we prize businesses by how few people they employ.
I don't know that that's true. It's just, we're going to get back into a little.
Yeah, we're going to get so sidetracked.
But yeah, I mean, this gets into like, I'm spending my career investing in technology that, yeah, we can get into a whole conversation about how this kind of streamlines, anyway, the ethics of stupid proofing farming. To focus on another driver, I think, that could actually get us into a glyphosate-free world, there is consumer demand. There is a glyphosate-free like label, probably more than one. I'm aware of at least one that actually does like a testing so that there's no like red. And that's actually based on residue, which is silly for a lot of reasons, but I won't get into it. That's another, I think, big driver here that is consumer demand to me is always tied to marketing.
I also think that's probably the most powerful mechanism for actually getting away from it. Also just resistance.
Yeah.
Like resistance.
That might be another massive driver here.
Yeah, which like I think unfortunately, okay, because this is the other like I guess like psychological or sociological effect of like stupid proofing farming. When you've stupid-proofed it and then there's a lot of stupid people around, then they don't make the smart decision, which is like we're dealing with a lot of resistance. And unfortunately, a lot of people are taking that opportunity to use more, to just like keep turning up the volume. And it's like, no, that's the opposite. That's making it much worse. So we actually need to turn down this and, you know, switch modes of action and plant more, you know, like do more mitigation and protect. There's a way, again, to your point, glyphosate is not inherently bad. It's not inherently problematic. If you use it the way it is meant to be used, it's when people use it problematically and then like it becomes a race to the bottom because you use it a little bit problematically and then the next year you need to use it a little bit more problematically and then you need to use it a little bit more and it just keeps going until like, yeah, until it you've ruined the technology by over applying it and now everything's resistant and now it doesn't work at all and it could have worked for much, much longer if we had not abused it so badly.
Absolutely. And that gets into the whole like, and I think the way I don't know that farming has been fully stupid proof, first of all, let me say, but I would say too, I think that what I'm hearing you say, the solution at least is education, actually, and it's education for farmers in a way that is different. Right now, a lot of education is driven by marketing, which is when you're trying to sell something, you're going to educate someone that you should use more of it, which is not better. And so we're not always historically, we go to kind of sources of power and those who hold power for kind of our educational message. And that's how you end up with a very kind of singularly focused message, as opposed to what might be better, which is bringing in a diversity of perspectives and actually giving voice to historical systems that work, that enable, I guess, a creative form of farming, which is, I think, what you're really talking about is kind of, yeah, what if you problem solve farm instead of just say, here's how, oh, if this, then absolutely this. It's more of a, look at all of these options that are on the table. What can I do to make my business the most successful?
Yes, that is absolutely what we should be promoting and rewarding. And my, like, to your point about, I think we just need to educate farmers. Like, unfortunately, and I'm about to say something real that a lot of people aren't going to like. Unfortunately, what happens when you stupid-proof farming is you get a lot of people around who aren't interested in being educated. They do not care about your modes of action. They do not care about they do not care about you trying to educate them. They're not interested. They won't be educated. They refuse to be. For many different reasons, right? Some of them because they're old and they don't care. Some of them are because they're young and they think they know better. Some, like, there's so much psychology around why people don't want to learn stuff, why they don't want to, you know, get better or feel that, you know, acknowledging that you can get better is at some level, people think, an acknowledgement that you're not good, you're not finished right now. And for some people, that's really hard.
But that's because they've been educated by someone else.
But like, yes, is that someone else, like their parents and every person they've ever met in their whole lives? And then, like, do you really think that like a USDA extension agent is going to somehow counter that by like teaching them about modes of action?
No, but that's a problem. Yeah, it obviously has to be earlier. This is not like an easy fix by any means I'm suggesting. I don't know that it's the thing that actually gets us to the end of glyphosate. But there is some educational barrier somewhere in farmer, I guess, development, if we want to put it that way, that starts really, really early. And it absolutely has to do with rural, urban, socio-political, like, it's a really complex thing. But again, I think this comes into a diversity of voices early on. I don't think you can figure out how to fix it from within agriculture which, like it or not, like, I don't know, I sit within agriculture right now. You kind of do too. I don't know.
This is like, from my perspective, if I was inventing the future, what I would do is just put, I like your tax. I'd take a tax, a really, really expensive tax on using glyphosate. Then some people would still be willing to pay it. It would still be worthwhile to use in some situations, but you'd use it really carefully and you'd be cautious and you'd use it exactly where it needs to be. You wouldn't broad apply it with a crop duster on every acre you own. You would be careful and cautious and very specific about how you use it. That'd be great. That would solve all the problems. And guess what? If you can't farm, if you can't keep your farm afloat without broad application of glyphosate, then you'd go out of business. Also a good outcome in my world. I would like that to happen. If you're bad at farming, then you don't get to farm anymore. That's great. Then your land gets to go up for sale. It probably caused a little bit of a drop in farmland prices as a lot of people exit all at the same time, because it turns out there was a lot of people who weren't that good at farming. And then guess what? Look at all that opportunity for new, young, and beginning farmers to enter the business and for other different models, that diversity of voices that you're talking about, to actually become a possibility. That is what I would do. I would either create, you could either do it with a tax, you could do it with a really harsh regulation that's actually enforced.
Yeah, it's tough to enforce, which is why I think, but I will say, and this is what I think might happen in Europe, but like, it would be a problematic to cold turkey cut. And I just want to clarify that it could happen in some places. If we were to cold turkey, and it can't happen in all places in the world, and we're in a global economy, so it would be a it's problematic for farmers in the country that lose access to that tool in the toolbox, right, before others do, and it actually would end up shifting export markets, which would be pretty disruptive on a global level. Anyway, that's why I think in thinking about what the end looks like there could be an end that was very abrupt. It could just be a blanket, we're not using this anymore because we've decided to delist it. I think that would be potentially pretty bad.
I can see that. Yeah. Everything takes time, you know. We are coming right up on 30 minutes, so I'm going to throw in a quick, like, reality check is, from my perspective, is just, like, we're not, like, glyphosate's here to stay until resistance is such a problem that it's just pointless to use it because it's not effective. Effective on any of the weeds that it matters most to use it against. And then we'll have way bigger problems, or we'll all just use dicamba for everything, I suppose. But
that would be really bad. That would be really bad. Dicamba will be illegal prior to glyphosate. God, I hope that at least, like, I would, like, if science is real, which it is, then dicamba goes first, way first, and honestly should have gone already. I think, in theory, glyphosate and this is, I'll go generalize and say chemical herbicides generally are going to be partially displaced by mechanical and electrical alternatives. Not really anytime soon. That technology is not there yet. We do not have enough incentives in place to commercialize those technologies today. And that's a fundamental, huge risk that, I mean, the U.S. is taking, but I'm seeing a lot of sticks. I'm not seeing a lot of carrots for good alternatives. And that's really, I'm scared about the end of glyphosate today because I don't see a good alternative to it.
But we don't have a good, in my mind, I know exactly why we don't have a good alternative. Because glyphosate is cheap. And why would you make a good alternative when, like, this, you can't, like, get away? So just, like, so step up a tax for 10 years, give these alternative, like, make, put people on the clock.
This is the reality check.
I know. But, like, yeah, that's why, if we, every inch you up regulation, which, like, we could up regulation, right? We could, like, a really aggressive EPA just, like, could do it. Every inch you amp it up, the more real alternative technologies become.
I agree. Or, I mean, the flip side of that is, why aren't we moonshot? Like, talking about weed removal as a moonshot, my big fear would be that glyphosate gets eliminated, and then we say, well, we still have this budget. That's what's going to the labor force. And it's terrible, and people get treated like trash, like they already do, and that's really, really, really bad. So, yeah, I don't really see a good solution on the horizon for this right now.
No, or it's like the only other way, like, out I see is a really. It's like collateral damage in, like, a much more transformative move. Like, if something traumatic happens with, like, corn and soybean markets, like, yeah, like, if you don't grow a lot of, like, if you don't grow tens of millions of acres of corn and soybeans in the Midwest, like, glyphosate's used on all crops.
Oh, no, you're still, that's the thing. You use glyphosate on, that's why I think cold turkey is so bad. I can afford to backpack spray glyphosate.
Yes.
I don't want to be able to afford to aerial apply.
But that's the thing. But glyphosate's really a problem mostly for row crop. Like, it's not as much of a problem else in other crops. I don't know.
Yeah. Right. It's not as much of a problem in terms of, no, but I mean, it's just that it's going to take longer for resistance to develop, frankly. But I mean, I can tell you for sure we were spraying. Yeah. I mean, in order to harvest hazelnuts, you have to have a weed free zone almost. Easier to spray. So
I mean that's true of everything, right? The Hoover Dam's soon going to be the bottom of the Colorado River. Like, everything is just a temporary solution. Like, I don't know, that's just like how nature works, right? Whenever you're working with nature, it's just how long you have. Like, nothing lasts forever when you're working in a natural system. But but glyphosate's only been around for 70 years and we've already almost ruined it. And it didn't need to go that fast.
That's true. Okay, this is taking a dark turn.
Yes.
And we're over time, so we're going to wrap it here. There are a million and one things that we just touched upon that we could definitely talk more about, but we won't. We'll just say thank you for joining. I'm Connie Bowen, and I'm joined by Sarah Mock, and this has been another episode of The End of Ag. If you like it, subscribe, share it. Also, apologies for some of the background noise. My dog has been destroying a bone while recording today, so I apologize. Thanks for tolerating it. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.